Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
So thank you for coming along to this debate, Crisis of the West. Western values have been extraordinarily successful, and yet we seem now rather on the back foot, unsure of the values themselves, and sometimes embarrassed about our own past. Beset with postmodern doubts, do we need to revive our belief and the importance of these values, or should we just accept that the age of the West is over? So, we have with us Geeta Sehgal, who is a writer and journalist and a prize-winning documentary director. She, like her mother, who was due to be with us, but Geeta has stepped in, we're very pleased to know, is a member of the Nehru Gandhi family. But like her mother, she has been a very independent and critical voice. And then Philip Collins, columnist at the Times, chairman of the think tank Demos, senior fellow at the LSE, and of course the former chief writer to Tony Blair. Kwasi Kwarteng is a conservative MP, former chairman of the Bow Group, who's been seen as a rising star on the right of the party. He was educated at Cambridge and Harvard, and he's a PhD in economic history. And relevant to this debate, he's written The Ghosts of Empire and War and Gold, A 500-Year History of Empire's Adventure and Debt. So I'm going to give each of them just 3 minutes to lay out their stall and to address the question, do we need to revive Western values or is the age of the West over? And I'm going to start off with Geeta.
Well, you know, if you were born east of the Suez, as my mother was and I was, and she was born under the British Empire, you might have thought that the World War II, a war between, you know, capitalist imperialist powers and fascists, was a war of two Western knowledge systems and values, sets of values. So, you know, I want to look at what we mean by Western values. Do we mean universal values, for which I stand, and had my mother stood before you, she would stand for democracy, for equality between the sexes, for free speech against the killings of writers with whom governments disagree, and so on. But let's go back a bit and look at, you know, World War II was perhaps the quintessential time where, when people talk about what you mean by Western values, I think, the defense of Western values was the fight against fascism. And I want to look at the figure of a resistance heroine honored in France, who was known as Madeleine, who was a radio operator in the resistance. And it turns out that Madeleine actually had an SOE identity card. I mean, she was a British agent, dropped behind enemy lines, the first woman dropped as a radio operator behind enemy lines, and her name on her identity card was Nora Baker. Well, still, of course, Western, French, English, American as her mother was. Baker was her mother's American name. But what was Madeline's? What did Madeline do? She survived longer. Radio operators were picked up very, very fast. They had a very low survival rate. She did the work of 6 radio operators. She survived for months and months with the Nazis hunting her. Eventually, she was betrayed. They never actually found her on their own with their vans finding aerials. And she ended up in Dachau in the dying days when the Nazis knew they had lost. They took women agents they'd arrested to Dachau, beat them up brutally, assaulted them. And she was shot, and her last words were Liberté. Her real name was Noor Inayat Khan. She was a Sufi Muslim, a musician, a children's writer, an illustrator, a pacifist. And as she told her SOE masters, she believed in the freedom of India and independence, and when she'd done with the Nazis, she was going to go to India and fight for independence. She stood for what you might call Western values, but I would call universal values. She stood against fascism at a time of world crisis against fascism. But if we frame our question in terms of the West and the other, we are going to really miss where our allies are. Because the things that are undermining the West come from within the West and from within Western policies. They come from the ways in which particularly, and I talk now about Britain, British governments have imported empire policies in order to manage minorities at home, seeing minorities as sort of infra-citizens to be guided by their chiefs and their rulers. I believe Kwasi's written about this in relation to empire, not to have full citizenship. David Cameron, a few years ago, criticized the policy of multiculturalism. A lot of people didn't know what he meant. They thought that he was attacking a mixed race, plural society. I don't think that's what David Cameron meant. He was attacking this kind of social policy, which was a pernicious social policy. And I was attacking it more than 20 years ago, in around 89, at the time of the Rushdie affair. When Cameron, I think, was probably still in short pants. But it wasn't understood what that was all about. But even though the Tories have attacked many of Labour's foundational policies, they continue in the same vein, in fact, because they cannot rid themselves of the idea that minorities are meant to be guided by priests and imams and various forms of fundamentalists. So Cameron has valorized his relationship with Narendra Modi, who is the Hindu fundamentalist prime minister of India. I mean, beyond the duty of two big nations talking to each other, as nations must, but actually putting his political eggs in Modi's basket and appealing to Indian voters because of his relationship with Modi. And when I see both of them bowing before the statue of Gandhi in Westminster Square, I feel a sense of massive irony that Modi, who is descended from the movement that killed Gandhi and is killing Gandhian ideals today, is being valorized by the British Prime Minister, and we of Indian origin are supposed to fall behind that.
Thank you.
Well, it strikes me as I was thinking about the crisis of the West that there's probably no better place to observe the last weekend before the apocalypse than just to come to a nice town and go to a literary festival in the sunshine. If there's a crisis of the West, it doesn't really quite feel like it here. And I just want to interrogate what we mean by this crisis. There is no question that Western societies, the rich democracies, have any number of deficiencies and flaws and problems that they need to address. And I'm not blind to that at all. But when we talk about Western values, we mean the best of Western values. We mean democracy, equality, human rights, the rule of law, the benign application of science. And these are great historic achievements. They're not, as Geeta has said, exclusive to the West, and nothing much hangs on calling them Western values. I don't want to get into that cul-de-sac of saying they're Western values. I would rather argue for them directly. They are good things. They are hospitable to the flourishing of human life wherever they arise. They arise, for example, as Geeta said, in India, a great adventure in democratic politics for whom there were many skeptics when it began in 1947. I was reading the other day a report in the Times of the day that said it is inconceivable that this country of very many languages can house a democracy. Well, it turns out 60 odd years later, not inconceivable at all. Still flourishing despite its setbacks and moments of crisis, but still flourishing. So these values house the most hospitable way of human flourishing there is. They're under threat to the extent they are for two reasons. One is economic. There's no question there's a passage of power from the West to the East in economic terms. In particular, of course, India and China. Now, China, you don't have the same obeisance to those rules of law and equality human rights that you have in the countries I was describing before. So we've got a challenge to that framework there with the immense economic power that China is currently gathering and the way in which China's using that economic muscle around the world, notably in Africa. So there's one very serious, genuine, material threat. The second is more internal and more subtle, which is our own lack of confidence in those, in the ideas that I've been commending. There are times when we are apt to blame ourselves for every conflict in the world. There may not be a crisis in the West, but there's very certainly a crisis in the Middle East. And it's quite common for people in the rich democracies to think, rather arrogantly, I always think, that in some sense that's entirely our fault. I'm not blind to the previous imperial involvement of Western nations in that region. But the notion that some of the ideological transformations in that region are entirely the result of things that we have done strikes me as both arrogant on our part, that people are simply puppets of what we do, and entirely historically illiterate about the nature of those societies and the way they've developed independently of us. So insofar as there's any kind of crisis in the West, it's about the decline of American power, the growth of China, and then this attendant lack of confidence we have in some of the greatest things that human beings have thought, which is to say democracy, human rights, equality, and the rule of law.
Thank you, Philip.
Thank you very much for your introduction. I tend to take a slightly different view. I'm sure you'll be happy to hear that from our two panelists. I don't want simply to repeat what they've said. I think the crisis is a bit more immediate than would be indicated by, you know, this beautiful setting in this very comfortable part of the world. I think if you look across Europe, and particularly in the Middle East, there very much is a crisis. There are peoples moving in their millions to escape war-torn areas. I think many of those people have an Islamic faith. They're not fundamentalists in any way, but they have a different cultural heritage, intellectual heritage. And to say that there isn't a tension, there isn't some degree of latent conflict between some of those ideas and what we may loosely call Western universal values, I think is a bit naive. I mean, clearly there is a problem when you see an atrocity like we did in Paris 6 months ago. That's not something that's usual. I mean, I'm 41 years old, and I've been to Paris many times, but I can tell you that the terrorism in Paris was an abnormal thing to happen. And clearly, if you look at this phenomenon, there is something to do with people of different faiths, inspired by different values, who want to enact extreme acts of violence. I don't think we can pretend that that isn't a problem, or that somehow it has nothing to do with a very different worldview. Clearly, it is a problem, and clearly it is ideologically, loosely, religiously based. Similarly with ISIS, for someone of my age, and someone as a historian looking at empire, the phenomenon of marauders seizing lands, setting up a religiously inspired empire, a caliphate, this again is abnormal, it's unusual, it doesn't happen very often in world history. I mean, some friends of mine mentioned the Normans in Sicily. They did something similar, but the extent to which they were motivated by their Catholic faith is an open question. So I don't think we can just pretend that there isn't a problem, or that there isn't some degree of conflict between differing values. And in this context, I think if there is a conflict, I don't want to talk about a clash of civilizations. I mean, that was very much the American sort of language at the beginning of this century. But there is clearly some unease about living in a world where there are different cultural absolutes. And I don't think there's much compromise that we can have with a phenomenon like ISIS. If 15 years ago we talked to you about ISIS, we would have thought, you would have thought I was mad. The notion of ISIS as late as 2000, the year 2000, was incredible. So to sum up, I would say that there is a conflict. I think there is a crisis of values or in terms of the weight that or your confidence, the West, universal values, the confidence that we have in projecting those values. I think there is a tension in communities within Britain who have different values, and the situation is much more acute in France, where you have a large Islamic population which is not remotely integrated into that society. These are big problems, and I think that what Philip suggested was that there is a lack of confidence, actually, in some of those values, whatever we call them. And I think, you know, we need to work out what it is, what those values are, and how we think they can be best promoted and people can be integrated to share that universal culture, you know, in our communities and also externally.
The debate. Theme one.
Thank you, Kwasi. So there is, I think Philip identified two ways we can think of a threat to what we might think of as Western values. And one of those comes from internally, our own doubts about reason and progress and democracy. And secondly, a threat from the actual situation on the ground from alternatives. So let's try and take those separately and begin with a threat internally. Geeta, do you think there is a threat to those traditional Enlightenment values of reason and progress internally?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a huge threat in Britain, in the academy, and in the US and perhaps other places as well, to the values of the Enlightenment, because they have been attacked by post-structuralists, post-modernists, post-colonial theorists, etc., as being the foundation of imperialist values and the export of and imposition of Western values on other subject peoples and so on. And there's some truth in some of that, but it is only part of the story, because of course those very same values were the values that the subject peoples used to rise against their masters and overthrow them and so on way back, you know, after the French Revolution. The Haitian slaves fought an enormous long war against the French Republic, which didn't want to export its values, and so on. So yes, the universities have these and it affects people like me who are campaigners on women's rights and so on, because you actually have, and I've had this reported recently by young people that I work with. One was a young African woman, a British African, who is at Goldsmiths College, London, who attended a seminar where the lecturer defended female genital mutilation, or said, well, we shouldn't really have a view on it because who are we, you know, to say anything. And the other was a Pakistani student in Cambridge, again, who attended a lecture. And you couldn't believe what he was hearing. He had not come to Britain from Pakistan in order to have female genital mutilation defended in the space of the university. So yes, there is a huge crisis of values. I founded a center called the Center for Secular Space. And to call yourself a secularist, that is somebody who defends freedom of religion, but also freedom from religion in public policy, I might as well call myself a racist. You know, it's like calling myself a paid up member of the National Front. Liberal donors who are funding Al-Qaeda public relations networks do not want to fund, and these are social justice organizations like the Roundtree Social Services Trust, don't want to fund people who are promoting secular values and fighting against things like forced marriage, domestic violence, female genital mutilation. You'd think these things are no-brainers, that you wouldn't really have to make the argument, but you do have to make the argument again and again.
So Philip, you were saying, actually, there's not really a crisis. We're all comfortable here. It seems to be all okay. Do you, that's not the picture that Gita's giving.
No, the point where I think there's no crisis is I think we ought to display great confidence in what we think. But doubt is where we start with this, of course. I mean, Descartes begins with doubt. That's where it all begins, isn't it? He thinks, therefore he is, because he knows he's aware of doubting. And to doubt what we think is, of course, is a
yes,
fine sign of progress.
Yes, but he ends up with a situation where he thinks he can build a true account based on reason.
Yeah, he does.
And isn't that the bit that's now under threat?
Yes, it is. It's exactly what's under threat. And to doubt the efficacy and the universality of your views is a very important critique. It's a very intelligent thing to do, to constantly interrogate your own views. So that's a good thing. The thing that which most intrigues me is something that I was prompted by Kwasi, which is to say that this sets of belief, democracy, human rights, etc., whether they are radically incommensurate with a religious view of the world as you see embodied in Islam. Now, my own view, in short, is that they are not, that they are compatible. Of course, I'm laying aside those of a very radical fundamentalist disposition who stop at nothing short of murder. I'm talking about the vast body of people who would profess to be Muslim who live in countries which are not currently democracies as we would constitute them. Is there a radical separation between that religious belief, which leads to a theocracy on the one hand, and the desires of people like me for the world to be democratic and free, etc., on the other? I think probably not. I don't believe in the idea of Asian values as a separate body which are incommensurate with what we're calling Western values. But that's an enormous
But before
claim.
That, there was a... You say doubt is part of the Western tradition, but we've ended up doubting ourselves, haven't we? And isn't that the core of the crisis here, that we don't really... we don't really believe the Enlightenment values in the way that we did once before.
Yes.
And isn't that a real threat?
There is a problem. We're doubting ourselves a bit in our politics. So we the strong strain of anti-politics and cynicism about politics. But we mustn't press it too far. We've got a majority conservative government with a prime minister who went to Eton. Things haven't changed that much. We may well end up with a Clinton in the White House. Things haven't changed that much. We're right to interrogate it and be vigilant about it, but things haven't changed that quite so much. But we do doubt also whether or not we have the right to impose these views elsewhere, whether we have the right to export these views. I think we doubt that.
Okay,
Can I come in on this export, actually? Because, you see, the problem with the neocons was that they didn't really know whether they were valorizing imperial values or exporting democracy, and they kind of forgot that there's that kind of bit in the middle where people, when they're faced with imperialism, fight for democracy for themselves, which is not the thing that was being imposed on them by others. So, there's a confusion there. Which sets of values are we, my family stood against British colonialism, but they didn't, for instance, as some Indians did, join up with the Nazis. They made a very conscious decision. Nehru was my great uncle, the first Prime Minister of India. My grandfather, Ranjit Pandit, was a Sanskrit scholar who died of his imprisonment. But he was also a fluent German speaker, and he could have happily sat out the Third Reich inventing Nazi Aryan policies for Indians. As if you read Paul Berman, Flight of the Intellectuals, he talks about the Nazis getting Arab scholars to develop fascist Arab Muslim ideologies that were anti-Semitic. We could have done that, but my enemy's enemy was not my friend. Indian nationalists were very clear that they were fighting the British Empire, but that fascism was an evil that had to be fought, and they stood with the European peoples. They, as victims, stood with the European peoples. Postmodernists are always victims, and they can never stand with anybody else against an evil that is even greater than the British Empire was. They were clear of that in their time. And my grandfather died of his imprisonment rather than, being a flunky of the Third Reich, which he could well have been. But I agree with Kwasi. I mean, ISIS is a phenomenon that really we could not have dreamed up. And it is very, very serious. But I think if we look at it as a phenomenon against which Europe has to close its gates, we're not, and therefore against the millions of very frightened, desperate people who are fleeing ISIS, we are really mistaking the nature of what that phenomenon is. It is an evil ideology, And like fascism from which it's defended, classic fascism, it is an internationalist ideology. When I say that the Hindu fundamentalists are fascists and the Muslim fundamentalists are fascists, they say you're being very Eurocentric in your views. Well, the thing is that, you know, those original fundamentalisms grew up at the same time. They were born at the same time as Mussolini and Hitler and so on. They read those people. They admired those people. ISIS is also British and French and German. I mean, it is here among us that people are mobilizing. And that isn't Muslims as a mass. That is certain people and groups that are mobilizing and managing the propaganda and going out to fight in Iraq and Syria and Somalia and Nigeria and elsewhere. They're coming from Britain to those countries, and they may be your sons and daughters, but because they're not only born Muslims.
But look, the fact that they're coming from Britain is significant, but we've got to make sure that we understand that this is an ideology. And I tend to be less sanguine than Phil about this. I mean, yes, a Clinton, yes, Cameron is a very much an establishment and reassuring figure, but the world is radically different from what it was when I was an undergraduate 20 years ago. And we can't pretend otherwise. And I think that if you look across Europe, we had a situation in Austria where an avowed neo-Nazi essentially almost came within 100 or thousands of votes of becoming a chancellor. We have a situation in France where it is very likely that Marine Le Pen will top the first round of the French presidential election. You know, under first past the post, she would probably be the head of state. And you know, we can't just pretend that this is normal times and, you know, it's, you know, with this, there's you know, is the clock still standing at 3 in Grantchester, or, you know, is there still you know, strawberry scones or whatever? I mean, it's a very different world, and we can't pretend that, you know, things are just going to carry on very smoothly. My worry is that, and this is the problem I have with what I think is a very broadly tolerant and sympathetic outlook, is that if people, you know, in the West, we had about 150 years of very, very, in Europe rather, very bitter religious wars. It's not taught very much in schools, but the 30 Years' War in Germany was utterly horrific. And it was broadly a confessional war. It took about 200 years for Europe to separate church and state. Even as late as the late 18th century, the whole Enlightenment. You know, the Jesuits were kicked out of Switzerland, they were kicked out of France. These were extreme measures, but there was a clear separation between church and state. The American Declaration of Independence, again, a clear, and the Constitution, clear separation of church and state. If you have a culture where religion is the absolute, whatever religion, it's not anti-Islam. If you were a Christian fundamentalist or a theocrat, there is a fundamental lack of compatibility between theocracy and the kinds of values we're talking about. And I think we have to square that. We have to face that boldly and full on. We can't pretend that we can somehow marry the two.
But what do we do about it? I mean, I completely agree with you that theocracy is absolutely incompatible with the sorts of values we're discussing. Let's imagine for the moment we had full confidence in that, and that part of our discussion wasn't a problem. That doesn't itself do a great deal to alter the world situation, does it?
No, I mean,
we wouldn't allow theocrats to flourish by giving them charitable status in this country, and that is what we have done. That is what we have done as a matter, or you, I've never been in power. The Tories and Labour have, politicians, you know, secular organisations cannot become charities because we're told Britain is a Christian state and you threaten the established order. So those of us who are fighting people who are dissident writers and fighting for the scientific temper and so on, we cannot get charitable status for our organisations. Whereas Sharia councils, which are setting up a parallel legal system in this country, have been given charitable status. You know, the organizations that are running them are run by murderous organizations that you know, for instance, they're the brains behind the attacks on Bombay in 2008, Mumbai as it's now called, on a train station, on various hotels, on a Jewish center, on cafes. You know, the parent organization of the Lashkar-e-Toyba, which is a particular terrorist group with the backing of the Pakistani state, has its ideologues sitting in Britain running charitable status Sharia councils.
Okay.
You know, this is a problem that the government has allowed to happen. It's not Muslims sneaking in and doing bad things. This has been endorsed by the state.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Theme 2.
There's agreement, I think, on the panel here, that there is a threat internally. We'll come to the external threat, which Philip referred to start with, but there's an internal threat. What is our response to that? I mean, do you want to say, well, we should insist on these values and impose them on people internally, forget about externally for a moment, but just internally, should we try and insist
on
that?
Two things. I mean, Britain's position in this Western context, in this debate about Western values, is somewhat anomalous, because we haven't, I talked about the separation of church and state, but of course we haven't really done that, because we've got a confessional state. I mean, the Queen is still the governor of the Church of England, we have bishops in the House of Lords. So nominally, we haven't really gone through that Enlightenment sort of French Revolution stage. We're still very much in the Ancien Régime. And that's where a lot of these difficulties arise, because we realize that, okay, we've got an established church, so we want to establish a lot of the privilege, we want to share a lot of the privileges that the established church has, faith schools, Church of England schools, with other faiths. And I think there is a big tension with that, which we haven't intellectually really resolved in our own minds.
So what's your answer? My answer, should there be more imposition?
My answer actually would be to have some form of, we need to have some sort of, not imposition, but we need to work out what it is, the relationship between the church and the state.
That sounds a little bit of a fudge there.
No, but you can't.
What do you mean?
What do I?
Are we trying to work it out at the moment?
Disestablish the church.
Well, I'm a conservative, so I don't actually believe.
For Enlightenment principles across the board, where the majority is a minority.
I would certainly do that. I think one of the great achievements of liberal democracies is the distinction between the public and the private. And I think it's very important to distinguish between them in this question. So there is a public realm in which we all have to live and share a common life. And in that public realm, you lay aside your religious sensibilities and your ideological preferences. And there's a set of rules I have no problem in saying everybody has to live by that set of rules in that public square. That leaves an enormous amount of space for people privately to carry their own preferences and to live their own forms of life, which, again, I'm entirely tolerant of. But there are two separate realms, and the example you gave, Gita, of the charities, I'm with you, I'd secularize it. That I think there are, in the public square, we ought to be secular, democratic, and very thorough about arguing for those values. And that is the trade-off there, is the quid pro quo, is that in your private realm, you do like what you like. I don't mind.
You see, I wouldn't go that far. I think that I'm not a disestablishmentarian. I like to get that word in occasionally.
I
am an anti-disestablishmentarian.
He's going to say flocky knock a little qualification a little bit.
Because I don't really see a massive need for it. I think we can accommodate faith schools. I think we can accommodate these things. But I'm very much a strict letter of the law person. I think if people step outside the law and actually commit crimes, I think they need to face the full force of the law.
But we have a national curriculum, don't we? I mean, if you're a Muslim school, for example, you don't have total freedom to follow your own curriculum on a religious basis, quite rightly.
No, that's absolutely right.
Isn't this a sort of internal contradiction of sort of liberalism and maybe of reason, you know, that the idea, well, if we're liberal, then we allow everything to take place, including those people who oppose liberals.
But Hillary, it's not just liberals, it's Michael Gove as an education minister. This is what's astonishing. Michael Gove understands and then gets attacked by liberals because he says there's a continuum between extremists and terrorists. And
yes,
I agree with that. I agree with Michael Gove. I'm a bit up lefty. But on that issue, I agree with that. However, his ideological commitment to destroying local authority control of state schools.
No, I'm totally in favour of that.
Let's not go down
there. Because led him to allowing more Muslim schools to be set up when he perfectly understands their dangers, and actually allowing some of these Muslim education trusts to take over secular schools with some line saying, oh, well, we won't interfere with a secular character school. Excuse me, you cannot run an you would not expect aeronautical engineers to be drawn from people who ran wreckers yards. And that's what's happening to the educational system.
The big story is the crisis of the West,
that Muslims are not deemed to be able to access education and the scientific temper and history and dancing and music and culture in the same way as any of you would expect for your children. That is a scandal. It is a scandal, and it's a scandal that Michael Gove, who understands these problems, I thought, presided over it as Minister of Education. That is the contradiction that we face.
Okay, let's try and take it out of the internal situation in the UK and to think the bigger picture. Yeah. Because the other point that, indeed, Philip made right at the beginning, is that we face, or the West faces, alternative powerful economic forces in the rise of China. I assume you focused on China rather than India because we see India as being carrying Western values or universal values to avoid the opposition.
It doesn't any longer.
In terms of the external threat, are we seeing the significant rise of alternatives to Western liberal values, and is that going to mean that they will bring their own values to the world stage, which will potentially, in the long term, undermine the values that we've been exporting?
Very good question, to which I'm not sure I know the answer. I do mean China, and I don't mean India, because I'm no fan of Modi at all, but I still regard India as a thriving democracy with the rule of law, independent judiciary, and all of those things. So I do think you can, notwithstanding the unpleasant nature of the current government, I wouldn't besmirch India with that. Whereas China, I think, is a different case entirely. But you've got the political and the economic, of course, are connected, because you've got an authoritarian capitalism, a sort of state capitalism, which does present itself as an alternative model for the world. So it's a big claim that they're making, and pretty successfully, at least in material terms, though not measured by anything else. If you think development is also measured by the freedom of the people who live under the jurisdiction, then China is a very poor model to emulate. But economically, it's very powerful indeed.
So now, if in 50 years, China is easily the largest economy, thought now to be like four times the size of the US economy in 50 years' time, is that going to mean that Western values are going to be eradicated?
I don't believe that. I mean, if you look at the history of China, it's never been, as far as I understand, a power that's tried to project its power across the world. I mean, there were no Chinese colonies in Africa or in Asia, there's a debate to which economic investment is part of empire. I mean, there's a long discussion about that.
You should write a book about
you're saying you don't think there's a threat to Western values from
the way the China, the Middle Kingdom, if you like. I'm not an expert on it, but from what I've read about it, I don't read the kind of the expansionist ideology that you know, the Mongols or the Romans or frankly the British or even the French or possibly the Americans have. I don't see, and you look around the world. I mean, one of the problems that we've had is really a paradox, in that America and Britain before America, it really involved itself as a global policeman. You know, Pax Britannica, all that stuff. World order imposed. And one of the issues we have now in terms of the crisis of the West is very much this dilemma, because clearly in President Obama, you have a president who doesn't believe in American imperialism in the way that some of his predecessors did. And he is desperate to withdraw. I mean, it's clear to anyone who speaks to his people in Washington that he doesn't want, he never wanted to be the president who would intervene massively in the Middle East. I mean, he, in a way, he won the Democratic nomination, he won the presidency on a ticket of trying to extract America from the region. But what's happened is that, you know, as you've probably traveled in the region, I travel in the region a lot in the Middle East, the Middle East governments are appalled that America is withdrawing from them, and they are seeking Russian influence. Russia's a country we haven't mentioned in this conversation. But clearly Russia, the role of Russia, the values that are not Western values or universal values in any way, really, is exercising a lot of influence and power in the Middle East. Now, is that something we should be concerned about? I happen to think it is.
And fundamentalist Iran.
Okay, so you're not so worried about China, but there's Russia, there's also, of course, there's the Muslim world. And these seem to be real threats, do they not?
I would worry about China.
To the dominance of Western values.
That's all true, absolutely. And I think we are seeing the consequences of America, which was withdrawn. Because an America which withdraws brings with it dangers as well as an America which engages. There's one other thing I'd just like to say about China, which in the context of the Western values, which I think I broadly agree with Kwasi that China's imperial ambitions are limited to owning the ports of every country in the world rather than
large
tracts
of land. They bought up huge amounts of Africa.
That may not be right. I concede that may change. But there's another way in which the what we're calling Western values in this conversation will, whether they, on a 50-year, 100-year view, start to come back through in China. We've had one aborted attempt to establish something along those lines. It's not to say that the Chinese people, 100 years hence, when prosperity is flooded through that society, simply accept the status quo politically in that country. That's not necessarily the case at all.
Theme 3.
Okay, so I think we've... again, got a certain amount of consensus here on the panel that there's not only a threat internally, there seems to be pretty serious threat externally from a variety of different sources, from cultures that don't uphold Western values. So the question I then want to pose, what are we going to do about it on the international perspective? We talked a little bit about what we're going to do internally. What are we going to do internationally? Should we be trying to impose Western values? Do we want to be fighting for Western values out there? Or not?
Can I pick up on something that Philip, a remark that he made regarding China and the development, the potential political evolution of China? And I've lived through, I mean, I was elected in 2010, so I was very much engaged with debates about the Arab Spring, which happened in 2011. And the view of the Arab Spring from Whitehall, certainly, and possibly from Washington, was that this marked an incredible opportunity in which Western values, in inverted commas, universal values, democracy, whatever you want to call it, could spread in the region. We all believed, I think mistakenly, that if we got rid of Gaddafi, and if we got rid of Mubarak, and if we got rid of Assad, spontaneous eruptions of secular democracy and people like me wearing funny colored rosettes, knocking on doors and canvassing, that would happen. And of course it didn't happen. And so my thinking has really changed over the last 5 years. I don't think it's inevitable, I hate to say it, but I don't think it's inevitable that these countries, such as Egypt, will evolve into democracies as we know them. I don't believe that it is an axiom of history that as people get richer, they necessarily become more democratic. I mean,
what do we do?
So what I would do is I would not impose, the last thing I would do is impose a political, try and impose or seek even through diplomacy to try to impose.
So what do we do?
So what we do is I think we have to, I mean, this sounds very brutal, but we have to make sure that there is a modicum of stability. So I'm not ruling out intervention. Sure. I wouldn't rule out intervention.
So in what sense is intervention not imposition? I'm not sure I understand that distinction.
No, there is a very fine distinction. You're a philosopher. There is a distinction between imposing a political system and trying to, in terms of how the rulers are selected, on trying to maintain stability in terms of the rule of law. And you've seen this in modern history. For example, when the Americans went to Japan and Germany, they imposed systems on those countries after the Second World War. In other countries, they tried to be, for good or ill, more stable.
Okay, intervention, not imposition.
Yeah, one other thing we do, and we will continue to do, is to trade. trading nations don't fight with one another as a rule.
That was sort of the First World War.
Someone wrote a book. Saying war had been abolished because of trade. And
if we're not going to intervene, which we're not, because one of the things we've lost confidence in recent years is our capacity.
Percy was in favour of intervention. I think he just wasn't in favour of imposition.
I agree. Yeah.
Well, we at the moment we've lost confidence in the capacity of Western governments. When I say intervene, I mean military. There's lots of other forms of intervention that you can have. There's diplomatic and economic, etc.
Is it right that we've lost confidence?
It's not right if we've lost confidence in every single instance. No, there are some instances
where there is an intervention, a Western-backed intervention going on. Thank God, actually. I never thought I'd say this, but there is. The Kurds. In the Syrian Kurds are being backed by the Pentagon. I think there's a fight between the State Department and the Pentagon, because actually a lot of the West has looked to the Muslim Brotherhood and so on as precisely the kind of stabilizing forces, which was a pernicious idea. But the Pentagon has seen the light, and there are special forces and aerial support and so on to the Kurdish fight against ISIS. And it's a very important.
Can I pick up on what? Because I don't think people realize this. I think that. And I know people in special forces and that sort of thing. But I think that a lot of the intervention is not debated on the floor of the House of Commons anymore. So if I look at Libya, I would guess, I don't know, but I think there are probably quite a few special forces in Libya. Now, is that an intervention? There are certainly people on the ground in Iraq. I think there are British soldiers on the ground in Syria. I don't know any of this, but that's my suspicion.
But they're definitely Americans on the ground.
Yeah, so are these interventions? They are interventions. Of course, they're interventions.
I think what we're coming to here, though I think we probably all agree on those examples, and there are things that can be done, and we should have the confidence to do them. But that's not going to change that region so fundamentally. So the answer to your question, Hillary, is what can we do? Is we can do a little bit, but actually there's a great deal we can't do. Therefore, I mean, quasi struggling for the answer to your question is not because he somehow can't think of an answer, is that there actually isn't a very good answer to your question.
Can I raise Tunisia? Because Tunisia is seen as the one country that remained fairly stable and, you know, didn't fall back into dictatorship or chaos or hasn't been completely taken over by fundamentalists. And quite often in a Western discourse, that's put down to the Muslim Brotherhood of Tunisia and Ennahda being moderates, right? Cut that one from your mind, because what happened in Tunisia was that and they got the people who did this got a Nobel Prize, but it's hardly ever been discussed. A good Nobel Peace Prize, not a satirical one, like giving one to Kissinger, where the trade unionists, the you know, the national body of trade unions, got together with the national body of you know, the chambers of commerce or whatever they were called, the business body. They allied because they saw the threat of fundamentalism. So under a Muslim Brotherhood government, they actually used a civil society, democratic process to set limits on what that government could do. And they were fighting, you know, even worse forces.
But the irony of that, if you speak to people in Egypt, and they mention this, they say that's because the French state was actually quite, they attribute that, the strong trade union movement, the strong secular forces, an established middle class. They actually attribute that to the colonial, rightly or wrongly, they attribute it to the colonial
history.
To the history and the colonial context.
But isn't, I mean, those all in a sense feel vaguely safe, in the sense that it's relatively minor in terms of the impact on us. If we're dealing with major powers, Russia being a good example, I mean, there are now people who are saying, you know, Russia might invade the Baltic states. Should we have the confidence of sort of Western values to think, no, we have to stand up for this, we're going to put troops on the ground? Or is it that we just feel, well, no, actually, we don't really believe enough about anything, and we just got to let the world go on as it feels?
Well, we've got a practical constraint as well. I mean, the example you gave is an apocalyptic one, and there's an intellectual question about whether we've got the capacity and the confidence to think we were defending something worth defending, which I think in extremists like that we would have.
Whether we'd have the actual capacity to do what you're asking to be done is an entirely separate question, and I'm not sure we have. I mean, I'm pessimistic and conservative about our capacity to do the things that we think we'd like to.
So the age of the West is possibly over.
No, there is a crisis. I don't think it's over, but there is a crisis. I mean,
but is the age of the West possibly over?
No, it's not over. It'll have a very, very long tail. America.
Okay,
America
will be a very long tail. So it's coming. The end of the West.
No, but it doesn't mean America will be the world's largest power for another 50 years. Yeah. I'd imagine.
But okay.
So
we've got
a number of
we've got a few decades left.
Yeah. But the question of is a very good question. If what happens, what actually would happen if Russia, and when they would do it, they always do this, and I've noticed it in the kind of interregnum after after the election in November and the inauguration in January. There's that kind of fallow period. And I remember the Israelis invaded Gaza. Do you remember that at that time? And if, let's say, in between November this year and January next year, Russia were to do a coup in the in the Baltics, what would we do? What would America do? And I think I hope I'm not giving anyone any ideas. But I think that sort of question is a very difficult question to answer. I'm not actually sure what the Western response would be, which actually underlines the subject of this heading.
Would a Trump presidency make the world safer, in fact?
Yeah. Well, forget about that.
That's a whole nother. I think most of us probably need the answer to that one.
I think the fact that I am not 100% certain that America would respond actually underlines and emphasizes this.
That we're not sure.
There is this doubt. Yes. And and this is what I was saying in my opening remarks, I think there is a crisis is probably too strong a word, but there is a sort of uncertainty surrounding our ability, our desire to defend Western values.
And does that mean you think, well, we need to reinforce them somehow?
I think we do, but I mean, this is where this is an open-ended conversation about how we reinforce those values. But there's certainly, I mean, the fact, even the phenomenon of Trump suggests, as I was saying earlier, these are not normal times. This is not something that happens every 4 years and is a normal run, normal kind of event. These are extreme events that are happening.
Well, that's an excellent point to end on. I'd like to thank our speakers for a really fascinating conversation. Many thanks for coming along.
Great. Thanks. That was good. Really good. Really interesting.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.